Today, we're diving into our critique of a theoretical white paper titled Mitochondria, Structural Coupling, and Intrinsic Health, which synthesizes Martin Picard's mitochondrial psychobiology with Humberto Maturana's philosophy of living to propose a totally new framework for health.
Yeah.
And jumping right into it, I think the structural separation of the theoretical distinctions from their clinical applications really weakens the paper's overall persuasive impact.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I saw the exact same thing right off the bat.
Right.
The main body of the text, which is sections 1 through 13, it operates at this incredibly high, almost stratospheric level of philosophical abstraction.
It really does.
The author is doing a massive amount of heavy lifting to establish this new epistemological ground. But the true strength of the work, the actual empirical and clinical utility, is just buried all the way back in appendices F and G.
Exactly, yeah. And by isolating the theoretical framework from the practical stuff like that, the paper inadvertently mirrors the exact same fragmented psychobiology that it's trying to critique.
That is such a good point.
You're basically forcing the reader to just disconnect the philosophy of living from the actual biological reality of the clinic.
Yeah, you really are. So for a suggestion here, the author just needs to integrate those clinical scenarios and the proposed research agenda directly into the core narrative.
Right, bring them front and center.
Exactly. You have to immediately anchor these massive theoretical claims in tangible biological realities. Don't make the reader wait 40 pages to see how this actually works.
I mean, think of it like presenting this revolutionary new computer operating system without showing any of the software that runs on it.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Like the code for the OS might be totally elegant, you know, mathematically flawless even. But until I see the word processor or the web browser actually working on the screen, I just can't fully grasp its utility.
Right. You need the application to understand the architecture.
Exactly.
And to give a concrete example of how to fix this, let's take the concepts of fatigue and depression.
Okay. Yeah.
Right now, those are hiding in Appendix F, specifically F1 and F3. The author should weave those directly into Section 9, right where they discuss stress, emotioning, and disease.
I see what you're saying.
When you introduce this super abstract concept of costly conserved drift, you should immediately follow it with the clinical example of how depression represents a literal collapse of viable action domains.
Tied to mitochondrial dysregulation?
Exactly.
I'm completely tracking with you there, but I do want to push back just a little bit on bringing the clinical data up too early in the text.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Well, think about Maturana's concept of autopoiesis for a second. It's this highly specific idea that a living system is a closed network that's continually producing itself, right?
Right. It's very conceptually pure.
Exactly. And I suspect the author intentionally sequestered the clinical data in the appendices just to protect that philosophical purity.
To keep it from getting muddied.
Yeah, because if you start talking about clinical depression in Section 9, aren't you worried the reader, especially like a classically trained medical professional, might just revert to the standard DSM psychiatric mindset?
Oh, I see.
You risk them mapping your completely non-reductionist theory right back onto their standard reductionist diagnostic categories.
I mean, I totally understand that fear. It's a highly valid protective instinct by the author.
Right.
But what's the alternative here? Philosophy without clinical grounding just feels way too speculative for a hard scientific audience.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
If you're asking the medical community to abandon their standard diagnostic mindset, you can't just offer them abstract logic. You have to literally show them that this new framework is mechanically superior right there in the clinic.
So you're saying use the clinical condition as the proof of concept for the philosophy itself.
Exactly. Don't let the philosophy float in the ether and just hope the reader connects the dots later.
Show, don't just tell.
Right. Instead of just defining costly conserved drift as a theoretical loss of adaptive range, show the reader how clinical depression is an observable collapse of a person's world.
I like that a lot.
Explain how the mitochondria's inability to appropriately partition energy forces the entire human organism to restrict its behavior. They literally pull back from their environment.
Wow. Yeah. Suddenly, depression isn't just a chemical imbalance in the brain anymore.
Exactly. It becomes a measurable reduction in the organism's autopoietic capacity. The theory suddenly comes alive.
That makes it so much more visceral. And, you know, we can apply that exact same logic to the empirical research methodology they included.
Oh, you mean the stuff in Appendix G?
Yeah, Appendix G.6 has this fantastic longitudinal study design. It lays out precisely how this theoretical organism-medium coupling can actually be measured in human subjects.
Yes, that appendix is pure gold, and it is completely wasted sitting at the back of the paper.
It really is.
They need to pull that out and put it right into the concluding sections of the main text.
Show the reader how tracking cell-free mitochondrial DNA in the bloodstream can be paired with psychological surveys.
Right, because the cells literally eject their energetic core when they're under stress.
Exactly. By combining those two metrics, the physiological and the psychological, you give the reader a real-world, measurable index of this entire philosophy. It proves to the reader that we can actually test this stuff. It moves the whole paper from a philosophical treatise to a really actionable scientific research agenda.
Which is huge. But if the author does move those clinical scenarios and empirical tests into the main text, I think we immediately run into a second critical issue.
And what's that?
Well, the heavy reliance on novel, highly specialized terminology risks alienating the exact empirical researchers who are critical to advancing this psychobiological framework.
Oh, the vocabulary. Yes, the proprietary lexicon in this paper is remarkably dense.
Very dense. I mean, we're dealing with terms like emotioning, costly conserved drift, organelle niche coupling.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. These are deeply nuanced, philosophically rich terms, sure. But if you hand this to a bench scientist or a practicing clinician, you're creating massive cognitive friction.
Yeah, you're basically demanding they adopt a completely alien vocabulary before you've even demonstrated why they need to abandon their old one.
Exactly. You have to assume the reader is a highly educated biologist who knows how the body works, but you definitely cannot assume they are fluent in Humberto Maturana's specific philosophical grammar.
Right, the language is actively getting in the way of the science here.
So my suggestion for this is that the author must anchor the new terminology with concrete, established physiological pathways before introducing the philosophical label.
Lead them from the known to the unknown.
Exactly. You have to build the bridge from their side of the river. You start with what they already know to be true in the laboratory.
Walk me through a concrete example of how you'd actually write that.
Sure. Let's look at organelle niche coupling. It's a brilliant concept for describing how mitochondria sense their environment, but the text just drops it in abruptly.
Yeah, it just appears.
So instead of leading with the term, first describe the observable empirical phenomenon. Detail exactly how chronic inflammatory cytokines bind to cellular receptors.
Right.
Explain how that binding alters the mitochondrial membrane potential and how it fundamentally changes reactive oxygen species signaling.
Paint that deeply familiar, grounded biochemical picture first.
Precisely. Because a bench scientist is reading that and they're nodding along. They know cytokines. They know membrane potential.
You're speaking their native language.
Yes. And once they're nodding along with the biochemistry, then you introduce organelle niche coupling as the conceptual wrapper for that dynamic.
You say, hey, this exact dynamic is what we call organelle niche coupling.
Exactly.
Now, I will say the author does try to address this exact problem. They provide a pretty highly detailed translation table located in Section 11 and, I think, Appendix B.
Yeah, they do have that.
So they clearly recognize that there's a language barrier here between the philosophy and the bench science. But I'd argue that a translation table is basically a crutch.
Oh, absolutely it is.
If the text itself isn't fluent, forcing the reader to constantly stop reading, flip back to an appendix to translate the word emotioning into bioenergetic action readiness, and then flip back, it completely disrupts the reading experience.
It's exhausting.
The text should do the translating in real time, within the flow of the narrative.
Let's take that exact term, emotioning. Instead of leading a paragraph with the abstract claim that emotioning is bioenergetic action readiness, just start by describing the physical state of the organism.
Like the autonomic nervous system?
Exactly. Walk the reader through how autonomic vigilance shifts ATP demand in the body. Describe how an organism perceiving a threat alters its redox buffering capacity to prepare for intense physical exertion.
Ground it in the hardcore physiology of a threat response.
Right. Blood flow shifts, heart rate variability drops, cellular energy gets reallocated.
Got it.
And then at the very end of that physiological sequence, you explain that this physical state of readiness is precisely what Machurna terms emotioning.
I have to admit, I do have a structural concern about this approach, though.
Okay, what is it?
Well, the entire point of the paper is to escape reductionism, right? The author desperately wants us to stop looking at isolated parts.
Yes, that's the core mission.
So if we spend all our time reducing these beautiful holistic philosophical terms to standard biochemical pathways like ATP demand and cytokine binding, don't we kind of lose the non-reductionist magic the author is striving for?
I see where you're going with this.
Aren't we just dragging the theory right back into the reductionist mud?
That is the absolute tightrope the author has to walk here. It's a massive challenge. But we have to be completely clear, the goal is not to reduce the philosophy to biochemistry.
Okay.
The goal is to use biochemical language to bridge existing scientific paradigms. If you just yell emotioning at a cellular biologist, they'll tune you out.
They'll dismiss it as soft science, yeah.
Exactly. But if you describe the ATP shifts with precision and then explain how those shifts represent a non-reductionist whole organism phenomenon, you actually bring them with you.
You have to prove that Maturana's philosophy is the best way to understand Picard's biology.
And you can only do that by speaking the language of biology fluently first.
That makes perfect sense. We're moving the reader from the physical mechanisms they already trust into the philosophical framework they actually need.
Exactly.
Which, you know, brings us to the core engine of this entire paper. Because the mechanism of redox congruence requires a much more rigorous exploration of potential biological counterarguments to solidify its standing as the bridge between lived experience and cellular state.
Yeah, section 5 is where we see this weakness most clearly.
For sure.
The text introduces redox balance as this master molecular register of structural coupling, which is an amazing idea.
It's brilliant.
But it paints a highly binary, overly neat picture. On one side, you have congruence, which is framed entirely as healthy and optimal.
Right.
And on the other side, you have oxidative or reductive stress, which is framed exclusively as pathology.
Which completely misses the evolutionary necessity of acute incongruence.
Completely. The paper lacks a robust discussion on how the biological system actually distinguishes between a positive, adaptive stressor and a maladaptive one.
And because of that omission, the boundary where a simple environmental perturbation turns into that pathological, costly, conserved drift remains entirely vague.
Exactly. It's just not defined well enough.
Now, to be fair, the author is very careful to insist that stress is not simply an external input, but a perturbation to a structure-determined system.
Which is a crucial distinction.
I actually love that distinction, because it means the organism's internal structure decides what constitutes a stressor.
Right.
But for a suggestion here, to make that biologically sound, the author really needs to fortify the redox argument by explicitly mapping the temporal and energetic tipping point where an adaptive perturbation crosses over into maladaptive incongruence.
You have to lean into the inherent messiness of biology to make this framework resilient. The author must explicitly contrast two very different types of oxidative stress to make this work.
Give me a concrete example of how that contrast looks on the page.
Okay, take the transient oxidative stress generated by intense physical movement. We know, and the author actually notes this in Appendix H, that intense exercise generates a massive spike in reactive oxygen species.
Yeah, ROS levels go through the roof.
Right. By the paper's binary definition in Section 5, that is redox incongruence. But we know from empirical science that it is a positive, highly adaptive energetic perturbation.
Exercise tears the muscle tissue down, creates oxidative stress, and the system rebounds to become structurally stronger.
Exactly. Now, you contrast that directly with the chronic generation of ROS caused by, say, prolonged sleep deprivation or systemic social adversity.
Two very different things.
Very different. But both states produce massive amounts of ROS. Both states severely disrupt redox congruence.
So the author needs to show the reader the exact biochemical divergence between the two.
Yes. How does the cell know one is a signal to grow and the other is a step toward systemic disease?
I think this is where we have to fundamentally challenge the conceptual neatness of redox congruence as it's presented.
What do you mean?
Well, isn't biology inherently incongruent? I mean, the physical friction of living, the constant breaking down of internal order against the environment, that's practically the definition of biological growth.
Yes,
And the author needs to address the concept of hormesis head-on in the main text to capture that required friction.
Hormesis being the well-documented phenomenon where a low dose of a stressor is actually beneficial.
Right. The paper needs to explain how a temporary acute loss of redox congruence is actually required to trigger mitochondrial renewal.
You're talking about mitophagy.
Precisely. The cellular process of clearing out damaged mitochondria to make way for fresh ones.
Right.
If your cells are perfectly congruent all the time, you never trigger mitochondria. The system stagnates and eventually fails.
So biology relies heavily on this friction.
It absolutely does. The CHEX needs to define the exact systemic conditions that take this healthy, required friction and lock the system into a pathological state of what the paper calls excessive energy resistance.
It's really about recovery time, isn't it? Or the presence of sustained inflammatory tone.
Exactly. Is it the lack of a biological return to baseline that causes the drift? Is it the temporal duration of the incongruence?
We need to know exactly where the biological tripwire is that flips adaptation into pathology.
We really do.
I love the idea of leaning into the evolutionary programming here, because historically, an organism's survival often relied on a temporary metabolic rigidity.
Oh, for sure.
If you're an early human running from a predator, you want your system to become rigid, hyper-focused, and incredibly inefficient in the short term just to survive the next 10 minutes.
You willingly sacrifice long-term autopoietic flexibility for short-term biological survival.
Exactly.
The incongruence saves your life.
Yes.
The pathology only arises when that acute survival mechanism gets trapped in a chronic loop.
Right.
And defining that exact tipping point from acute adaptation to costly conserved drift will make the concept of redox congruence undeniably powerful.
It stops being a binary switch of good versus bad.
Right. And it becomes a dynamic temporal gauge of an organism's entire history.
It grounds the entire philosophical framework in the harsh, undeniable reality of cellular survival.
It really does.
It shows the reader exactly how the organism's past environmental coupling dictates its current and future biological capacity. It's really the ultimate synthesis of philosophy and empirical science.
Well said. This has been an incredibly rich breakdown of a truly ambitious piece of work. Let's briefly summarize the core feedback to ensure the author has a clear roadmap for the next draft.
Sounds good.
First, move the clinical implications and the empirical study designs from the appendices straight into the main body of the text. Do not make the reader wait to see the biological reality of the philosophy.
Definitely.
Second, introduce established, accepted biological pathways before you apply the novel philosophical vocabulary. Lead the empirical reader from the biochemical mechanisms they already know into the new conceptual wrappers you're providing.
Super important.
And third, sharpen the concept of redox congruence by explicitly defining the boundary between adaptive biological friction, like hormesis, and maladaptive drift.
These are actionable structural refinements that will take this material from a fascinating theoretical proposition to a robust, actionable scientific framework that the medical community can actually use.
Absolutely. We invite the listener to implement these structural and conceptual refinements, bring the clinic into the philosophy, and submit the revised material back in for further critique. We would love to see how this evolves.